Hi, this is Sarah. If you like this episode of Let's Talk About Sects, you can listen to my audiobook, Do As I Say, How Cults Control, Why We Join Them, and What They Teach Us About Bullying, Abuse and Coercion. The audiobook will be available on Audible, Apple Books, Google and Kobo from the 28th of June. A link is in the show notes.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Journalist A.M. Gitlitz released his book, I Want to Believe, Passadism, UFOs and Apocalypse Communism, earlier this year. In it, he explores the fascinating world of the Passadists, a Latin American Trotskyist group who are best known today for their zany beliefs around extraterrestrial and dolphin intelligence. But their movement had a lot more to it than this, and in its later days would devolve into a cult around the authoritarian leadership of Jay Posadas. Welcome to Let's Talk About Sects, a podcast about cults around the world. I'm your host, Sarah Steele. A.M. Gitlitz drew on considerable archival research and numerous interviews with ex and current Posadists to write his book, and the author spoke to me about the more cultic elements of the unusual socialist movement for this bonus episode of the show. Without further ado, here's our interview. Well, first, congratulations on the book. I found it such an interesting read, so I'm really looking forward to chatting further about it. And I thought we'd just start with, for those who are unfamiliar with the Posadists, if you could give me a bit of a roundup of who Posadas and his followers were, just in a few sentences. Bit of a challenge for you.
Sure, yeah. I can do it short, pretty short, I think. Posadas was a leader of Latin American Trotskyism from Argentina. He was the leader of the majority faction of the Trotskyists in Latin America in the 50s and 60s. In the 60s, he split off and formed his own international, the Fourth International Posadist, which had its own idiosyncratic approaches to Trotskyism and socialist revolution. But today is best known for its most idiosyncratic features, which were a optimism towards contact with extraterrestrials, and its analysis along those lines about the UFO phenomena, the belief that there needed to be a nuclear war for communism to be fully realized on Earth, and some very late in life writings about communication with dolphins.
Yes, indeed. Your work talks about how the Posadists became best known for their pretty unorthodox beliefs. But I guess I was somewhat surprised to find the book being such a real history lesson, which had a lot of detail about the global geopolitical landscape that they came out of. And so I wondered if you had a thought about where or when it was that you think Posadas really turned into more of a cult leader and became so highly controlling of his followers.
Yeah, you can really pinpoint it in the 60s when his movement, like I said, broke away from the larger Fourth International tendency of Trotskyism. I'll go into what Leninism and Trotskyism means a little bit later in the interview, but basically the Trotskyists were a minority revolutionary socialist group, internationally organized, opposed to the Stalinist or the USSR-led tendency of the Third International that was founded by Lenin. So Trotsky was exiled and he formed his own international before World War II. And Posadas became a leader in this international after the war. And he became a leader because he was a very good organizer. He was a very charismatic character, very diligent at performing his tasks of, you know, putting out a newspaper, you know, getting the newspaper distributed, starting cadres in different regions of Latin America and formulating those cadres into parties that more or less followed the line of the larger international that was based in Europe. So he was really well liked in the international for how good he was at his job of corralling the Latin American sections. But in the late 50s, early 60s, there was a power struggle in the international. Posadas believed that him and Latin America in general, and the third world in general, the colonial and semi-colonial states, were not being treated well by the European leaders. And so he split away and claimed that he was the leader of this new fourth international. And at first, most Latin American Trotskyists agreed with him, and a lot of young European Trotskyists also joined his international and formed new sections in Europe and to a lesser extent, other places around the world. But he set this international up to be very top down. He called it monolithism. So really, he was the prime mover and the last voice, and everybody had to conform to not only his political analysis and his view of what the party should do, but his view of how people should live their lives. And at first in the 60s, a lot of people conformed to this because it was a relatively powerful and influential movement. And I'll get into some of their legitimate achievements later. But things started to fall apart in the mid-60s, around the events of Guatemala and Cuba. There was a lot of repression against communists in general, and the Posadists got a lot of that. A lot of members were tortured and killed in Brazil and Argentina. A lot were imprisoned, you know, all throughout Latin America. And also Posadas was coming up with some of these strange beliefs. He was denounced by Castro, and they became sort of a joke, and the party sort of fell apart by the end of the 60s. And in the 70s, Posadas began to even go against the more intellectual people in the movement that were kind of keeping his stranger, more manic impulses in check, and he expelled them all and really turned it into what we recognize as a more stereotypical cult, where it was all about the life in this one house where Posadas lived, then in exile outside of Rome. And he became very focused on the minutiae of life in this villa until he died in 1981. But really that cult-like mentality began to take hold, and people were expected to conform to that around 1963 to 1965, and it just deepened until he died in 81.
Yeah, that sounds right. And I think I mentioned to you in our correspondence that I had the Posadists on my rather growing spreadsheet for a while, but I'd done a little bit of research and thought, oh, maybe they weren't really a cult, maybe it doesn't belong there. But based on reading your book, I believe that they definitely do. And so I wanted to put the three criteria that I use for the podcast to you and see if you could speak to each of those criteria as to how Posadas fit with these. Mm-hmm. So the first one is a charismatic leadership that closely controls its members, particularly with regards to their disengaging with the group and its ideology.
Yeah, so like I said, there was this monolithic structure to the movement. So normally in Leninism, there's supposed to be this concept of democratic centralism, where the base gets to vote on its leadership and recall leadership if they're not doing a good job. In practice, this usually takes the form of like a small, like democratic becomes very small and centralism becomes very big. But nowhere is that more the case than Posadism, where really you could not challenge Posadas. People, you know, the newspapers of the Posadas movement were just filled with the essays, the screeds of Posadas, and there wasn't a lot of give and take between the base and Posadas. There, you know, the intellectual core could influence him, but it was really him who had the final word. And so part of why he was accepted as this monolithic figure is because he was incredibly charismatic. Everybody who met him described him as a very magnetic figure. He would speak for a long time, for hours, these speeches that got transcribed into these articles that filled the papers that are almost unreadable. But apparently listening to them, there was this kind of rhythm, this humor, this wit that sucked you into it. And Posadas would also have these one-on-one sessions with people that people described as sort of a psychological session, even something that reminds me of a Scientologist audit. And this was, people were expected to do this when they entered the movement, when a new cadre formed. You know, maybe you were a young socialist and you found a Posadas newspaper and you thought, oh, okay, this is the guy. He like takes nuclear war really seriously. He knows what we need to do to have socialism. He's a very hard figure. You start a cadre. Somebody from the International, should be Posadas himself, but maybe one of the other intellectuals, comes and makes sure to have a one-on-one session with you to kind of like really get you into the mindset of what it's like in the Posadas movement. There's a lot of asceticism to it, you know, refraining from alcohol, refraining from sex. You have to cut off your relationships with people outside the movement, stuff like that. And if you want to leave the movement, or if you're criticizing the movement, you will get these self-criticism sections that were very common in revolutionary groups in the 60s and 70s, where basically you were what you've done was alluded to or described in a meeting, and you were given this kind of group shaming and probably some kind of punishments of a certain kind of task. So people were very discouraged from leaving the movement because they would have to go through this process.
Yeah, I found there was a portion where you were talking about his recordings, and you'd mentioned this, I think his colleague had referred to the sinister invention of the reel-to-reel tape recorder. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I found that so interesting because so many of these cultic groups that I look at, that's just a huge key to how they spread their message amongst dispersed followers, I suppose, is just these endless ongoing tape recordings. It's like it's a really common feature.
Yeah, and interestingly, I can't get a hold of these tape recordings. You know, I don't think that the audio itself was distributed. It was always the text. He would have somebody transcribe it, and I have transcriptions of, you know, nearly everything, like full transcriptions of like morning meetings he had, but I can't get the tape. I think his son still has it in Buenos Aires, I imagine. And without that, I don't really understand Posadas, unfortunately. There's even a lot of, you know, song, he would sing a lot at meetings too. And, you know, so, that's a, but I think that'll come out one day, hopefully.
It doesn't quite translate to, the written text then.
No, I mean, if anyone's curious, they can go to Marxist.org and read some Posadas texts. It's pretty difficult to sit and read all the way through, even if you're familiar with the jargon.
Mm-hmm. The second of my 3 points is who think that they have access to the truth and that the rest of the world is wrong.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, absolutely the Posadas believed that although they were very small, even at their height, they, you know, probably only had a few thousand members, they were the inheritors of Trotsky, Lenin, Engels, and Marx. They were in this canonical lineage, and they deserved to be the international, the Posadas International, because Posadas had overcome Trotsky, and this means they had the absolute correct line. They were the intellectual vanguard of proletarian revolution. You know, Leninists believe that the workers themselves will lead the revolution, but they need this vanguard party, to translate their ideas and to push them forward. And this is initially what Trotskyists and the Posadists conceived of themselves doing. Although as the working class base of the movement quit throughout the 60s, it became all about this idea, this access to the truth. And it became all about publishing these newspapers, spreading them out to, especially to leaders of the USSR and China and Yugoslavia and what they believed to be the worker states, and sharing their truth with these leaders under the delusion that they were reading them and taking Posadas very seriously, and that Posadas would become this kind of, was this, you know, very influential person. And that influence was derived from the harmony of his movement, of the militants, and of how they were living his lives. So it's not only that he was a smart guy and he had a good analysis and he saw what was going on in the world, but also he was training the people around him to live communism in this way that gave him that vision. And so if somebody acted out, if somebody disobeyed him, that was creating a disharmony that could, you know, hinder his access to the truth. And of course, all the other Trotskyists, let alone there's this, you mentioned the rest of the world is wrong. He didn't consider any of the other Trotskyists to have any good ideas whatsoever. In fact, he was a lot more interested in, you know, the bureaucratic leaders of the Soviet Union, what they thought, than what the other Trotskyists thought.
Yeah, I think this sort of us and them, black and white, right and wrong type thinking is becomes a big problem in so many circumstances. And so the last point that I have is that they're highly secretive about the workings of their group to outsiders.
Yeah, I mean, even investigating the book, I had to put together some of their coded language, some you know, terminology that they use for certain things, especially the membership. Like, each membership was referred to by an initial, and the initial referred to a party name, which was different than their public party name, which was often different than their legal name. And this is very common in Leninist organizations. Actually, the Bolsheviks themselves kind of pioneered this system because, you know, the Bolsheviks at times were an illegal or clandestine party. In certain situations in Latin America, if you were a revolutionary organization or a left organization at all, you needed to be underground, and the Posadists were underground for quite a long time. But even in situations where they were legal, in Europe, in Italy, or in the UK, or in France and Belgium, they still had this kind of internal security because they believed that this repression could come at any time. Members could be rounded up the way that they often were in Latin America. So for sure, they had this clandestine security culture within their party structure.
I'm going to skip ahead to a question I had a little later down the list, because I think that really feeds into it. And that was a quote from your book in which you were talking about Posadas's opponents latching onto the UFO beliefs to sort of ridicule his sect. So Posadism was so similar to most other Trotskyist groups, they had little ammunition to politically attack Posadas, as his cult of personality, abusive militants, rabid anti-imperialism, paranoia, extreme zigzagging, and catastrophism were features more or less present in nearly every other tendency. And I thought that was really interesting. And I mean, I look at all sorts of cults and I see them rise out of all kinds of belief systems, whether religious, political, New Age, something else entirely. And so I wondered if you had any impression of whether there's something about this specific area of politics and maybe the time period as well that lent itself to the rise of those types of behaviors.
So I think that a lot of the stuff in Posadism just comes from Leninism. Like, it's just he was a strange guy and he demanded some strange things from his militants, but it's arguable. And actually I'm pretty influenced by a book called On the Edge, Political Cults of the Left and Right, by two former Trotskyists named Dennis Turesh and Tim Walforth, that argue that a Leninist organization, even the ones that don't have these kind of spectacular scandals of sexual abuse or megalomaniacal leadership, if they're properly functioning, will have a kind of charismatic leadership that disciplines the base, that believes itself to be uniquely able to analyze world events and lead the revolutionary masses, and do so in a clandestine fashion. So they propose that instead, they're not like anti-socialists or anti-communists, but they say that instead groups should really emphasize democracy, probably scrapping democratic centralism altogether, but at least really make sure the movement is totally democratized and value the freedom of all of its membership. And I'll just read a quick quote from them. They say that healthy political organizations and movements are characterized by dissent, disagreement, and conflict rather than by stultifying conformity. People need to abandon the widely held view that political organizations that permit frequent important disagreements among their memberships are unsuitable to exercise political power. We defend principles of political involvement and political action. However, such involvement needs to be kept within the framework that permits healthy debate and maintains an independence of each individual. And actually, I think one of them is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and argues that this is the kind of group that, you know, is a good non-cult socialist organization. And I don't hear people often referring to DSA as a cult, no matter how much they don't like them. But to be honest, I'm not so sure about this framework, this like sort of spectrum of like a free socialist organization to a properly Leninist, you know, cult type organization. Because I think in theory there is something valuable to the Leninist formulation. And although I've never been in a Leninist organization myself, and I don't really have a lot of desire to submit to that kind of discipline, I wonder if it's possible to have some element of these criteria, which are, you know, very common in radical and subcultural milieus, that can be very fulfilling for people and even important to creating a positive change in the world without being abusive. And in Posadism, I think you see that there is this kind of valiant effort of its militants to who really believed in the ideas of Posadas, you know, long after they were kicked out or left the movement voluntarily, but understood it was becoming this closed kind of megalomaniacal cult. So I try to separate the two things and not just say that, well, of course, Posadas became a cult leader because Leninism is a cult itself. But I think that's, you know, it's a, it, I guess I'll leave it up to the reader whether those things are really linked or not.
Mm-hmm. I'll switch back to the last couple of questions I have, but I don't think it'll do those who believed in Posadas many favors. So I might have to chuck in an extra one for you to look at what was appealing about the belief system, because I think these are probably going to frame it a little bit negatively. But can you describe your impression of the day-to-day life of the Posadists during the later part of the group's existence under Posadist leadership, including the limitations and aspects of control?
Unfortunately, the very last days, like the last 5 years or so, I haven't been able to interview anyone because these are the people. So basically around 74 or 75, Posadas kicks out all of the old Posadists in the movement, all of these people that many of them founded the movement with him in Argentina in 47 and were still with him in Europe in 74. And this includes his wife, by the way. He kicks his wife out of the movement. And after that, it's all very young people, many of whom had never read Trotsky or Marx. They've just read Posadas. And so it's really just, it's all about him. And these people are still, a few of them are still like in this network that like spreads Posadas's ideas. And although a couple of them have helped me out a little bit, like find some texts, I've only interviewed a couple, one current Posadas in Latin America, but he didn't go into much detail. So I don't know what life was like besides these internal documents. And those did include a lot of very brutal criticism sessions, some very painful expulsions, a lot of stuff going on with his idea of revolutionary morality, which is really focused on sex, but also of him trying to, you know, after he expelled his wife, he married or, you know, had a partnership with another young militant. But then it seems like in his last year of life, he tried to do the same thing again with another young militant 4 years later. But I just don't have all the details on that because I'm just reading these documents that are somewhat coded and I have no secondary sources to kind of confirm or cross-reference it. So in the book, I explain what I think, what appears to be going on. But I can tell you about the life of Piero Leone, who was one of the high-ranking members of the Italian section throughout the 60s and up until 74. He was expelled in this wave of expulsions. And he actually, in his memoir, Vicious Circle, which you can find online, he gives a list of his daily tasks. So I'll just read through that.
Perfect.
This is what he had to do every day. A, write the newspaper, print it, spread it. B, attend meetings, congresses. Organizations of the Italian left are often invited or uninvited guests. C, meetings to discuss the international, national, local, and party status, as well as specific problems. D, participating in cadre schools in Italy and sometimes abroad. These are like training sessions for new cadres or young cadres. E, circular writing, of which I was concerned with. The regional committees, often formed by one person, to direct both the political analysis of the situation and activity to be carried out. F, public propaganda activities. And then he provides some more detail. A, the most important thing was the newspaper. It first came out monthly, shortly after the 15th, then weekly. For a brief period in 1968, it was also biweekly. The newspaper meant A, deciding what to publish, B, translating Posadas' documents, usually occupying the majority of the paper. C, write the two or three articles in the Italian section. D, at the last moment, write the editorial. E, make the layout and bring everything into typography. F, correct the drafts. G, send the newspaper to a series of addresses, of which only a few were real subscribers. H, sometimes they also brought copies to some newsstands to sell. And then he goes into some details about the congresses and meetings, of which, you know, were constant on a national and international and a European-wide level. And he did all this, by the way, while he was sort of a personal... When Posadas was exiled to Rome, he went into Leone's home. So he was running personal tasks for Posadas. He also had a wife and a newborn child when Posadas arrived. And he had a job, and he was a student. So he just describes this in how exhausted he was at all times. And there was the only respite he had, he said, was when he was studying, was when he had some time to go to the university. And he describes, you know, that even if he completed all these tasks, even if he became very efficient at completing these tasks, he would be rewarded with more tasks. So there was this escalating spiral of commitments, of which there was no end to. And then also in 74, like I said, he gets kicked out. And he struggled to stay in, you know, even when he saw things falling apart around him, he sort of like, even after he had been sort of denounced and like shamed in one of these criticism sessions, he wanted to stay in the movement. So he describes his life as being totally miserable. He's totally alienated, exhausted all the time, but he didn't know anything else. He didn't know how to get out of it, which is, and Leone calls Posadism a cult. He's very explicit that it's a cult. He says, I don't like the idea of people calling it a UFO cult, because we didn't talk about UFOs all that much, but it absolutely was a cult.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, I think there was a section of your book that spoke about some of the various limitations that sounded very, very culty to me. So any signs of individualism in behavior or opinion were mercilessly critiqued. All major decisions, such as moving apartments or taking a new job, were subject to approval. Having children needed to be approved by the party, and often those requests were denied since raising children could distract militants from their work. I mean, it's really common in these groups to just have so much to do every day that you're just exhausted all the time, because that takes up all of your brain space. So, you know, there's not a lot of room left to question what's happening.
Yeah, and you mentioned these kind of this approval that you had to get for certain things, and I alluded to the revolutionary morality earlier. One thing Posadas would do, and he did this to a lot of his, you know, top militants, like Guillermo Almira, who's passed away last year, but a very important socialist thinker, like well known amongst the left in Mexico and Argentina. He was asked to come to Europe after Posadas was exiled there, but his wife was told to stay in Argentina. And this is a common thing Posadas did, because he believed that if couples were separated, all of their libidinal energy, all of that sexual tension, would go into their political work. And this is something he did to a lot of his militants. And that paranoia kind of, you know, I imagine the tension built up to those militants who were basically forced to be celibate by Posadas. But that paranoia that they weren't being celibate built up in Posadas's mind. And in, like I said, in 74, he believed that a lot of them were sleeping with his wife and with other young militants. I don't think that this was really happening. It could have been. It's hard to know for sure. But you could tell that these questions of how people were living, people's private lives in general, their inner desires and how they're acting on them behind Posadas' back, were really driving Posadas to demand extraordinarily abusive things of the people below him.
Mm. Yeah, I did wonder when reading that whether he did honestly have that paranoia and belief that they were sleeping with his wife or partner at the time, or if he was using it as an excuse to kind of chuck them out.
I think he might have really believed it, but again, it was convenient for him to believe it as well. So it's possible he didn't. It's hard to totally get into his mind, but one thing was for sure. He often talked about how he didn't sleep with his wife at all for years, you know, since the birth of their last child or almost never. he would sort of brag about that as like as his kind of ascetic practice. But he also wanted to take up a new young partner to have another child, and this was around the time that he exiled her. So it was very convenient that he exiled his wife at the same time, and then also he exiled the boyfriend of the young woman who he wanted to have a partnership with for some indiscipline. So it all kind of works for him in a certain way. But I do think he was being totally honest with these accusations in terms of what he believed was truly occurring.
Mm-hmm. Mm, interesting. And so regarding the Posadas' more extreme beliefs, I thought you did a great job in demonstrating how they were formulated and how it does them a bit of a disservice to reduce them to these kinds of sound bites. And I felt like the UFO perspective sounded way less zany to me through reading your book. It gave me a real kind of understanding of where that belief system was coming from. But obviously that is still what they're majorly known for at the moment. So I wondered if you could just talk a little about the UFO beliefs and then the later dolphin related beliefs in particular.
Yeah, I actually think that the UFO stuff, and there's really only one essay that he ever published on it, which you can find translated on Marxist.org. Some of the best stuff that he's written, like he basically has the same opinion as Carl Sagan. And I'll describe what that is after I talk about the background of it. Dante Minozzoli was one of these intellectuals in the movement who helped form it in Argentina in 47. And he always had this obsession with science fiction, with futurism, with cosmism, which was a faction of the Bolsheviks that believed in that for us to be truly communist, we need to go to space. We need to have immortality. And that, you know, those beliefs eventually led to the space race. So in 47, Minozzoli, you know, saw the news spreading the world about the Roswell crash and flying saucer sightings in the United States. And though that news led to more sightings around the world, including flaps of UFO sightings in Argentina, Minozzoli really believed that in this post-war nuclear age, aliens had come to kind of watch humanity as it progressed into socialism. And he believed that at a certain point, they would, you know, before the revolution or after the revolution, they would land and, you know, invite us into this intergalactic community, like basically what happens almost exactly in the backstory of Star Trek. But in 47, when he said this stuff, the other militants were like, all right, this maybe let's not talk about this publicly. It's fine for you to think about this, but this is really not what we're doing right now. But flash forward to the 60s when the Posadists believe that they are, you know, the group, like they are the intellectuals who are thinking the world in the best way. Minozzoli said, we need to be talking about the UFOs. This is like an important, you know, working class people want to know what these things are. We as Marxists are the best ones to interpret the phenomena. Let's talk about it. And other intellectuals in the movement still thought it was ridiculous, like Guillermo Almira still wanted to forbid talking about it. And Posadas kind of gave this speech, which became this UFO essay, as a way to mediate. And in the speech, he says that, yes, there are UFOs. They are aliens. And if we're to believe that aliens have such an advanced society that they can send craft here to Earth, they must have overcome or have never gone through the liberal nation state capitalism and, you know, near nuclear war, apocalyptic capitalism that we have right now on Earth. So they must be far more advanced. And if we can contact them, we should, because they will help us go to the next stage, which for Marxists, of course, is communism. Then he, at the end of the essay, he says, but we shouldn't really worry too much about what the UFOs are and how they live, because we have everything we need on Earth right now to get to that next stage. We can get rid of poverty and homelessness and crime and war. We just need to follow the program of the Fourth International. And that's kind of, and then with that, he put the idea to rest. And it did get published in a few of the newspapers, and he became like an in-joke of Trotskyists, you know, laughing at him for writing about this. And then later it became the thing that he was really known for. But this idea was basically the same thing that Carl Sagan and his Soviet counterpart, Yosef Shklovsky, argued in the book Intelligent Life in the Universe, where they, using the Drake equation, mathematically prove, or so they argue that they prove that there are about 100,000 intelligent civilizations, communicable civilizations, in our galaxy alone. And if we have an opportunity to contact them, we should, because they will have reached a level of sustainability that implies they have the solutions to all the problems that we have. And he enacted this through the expansion of SETI, the search for extraterrestrial life, and things like the Voyager gold disc, which was like a message to civilizations launched on a spacecraft with a map to come to Earth. And shows like Cosmos, which helped popularize SETI and other scientific ideas. And Sagan had a lot of very socialistic ideas as well. He wasn't very open with his politics, but he seemed to be sympathetic, to say the very least, about socialism, along with his wife, Ann Jurian, who wrote a lot of that stuff as well. So I think the fact that the UFOs have made Posadas infamous today, a lot of people see that as mocking him, as saying, well, look at this crazy Trotskyist who believes in UFOs. I don't think people are mocking him so much because of the UFOs or the dolphins. I know you asked about that. I'll describe that in just a second. I think they're mocking him because he really believed that there was going to be a socialist revolution, like within his lifetime, like in the 60s or the 70s. And it's hard for us to believe that today. And so that's why a lot of the focus on the book is of us losing that kind of ability to believe in something different. And I see that being as kind of sublimated to talk about aliens, about this other that we can fantasize coming and rescuing us from this like a capitalist realist stasis. So, but quickly, I will talk about the dolphins. So this was something that he was really only interested in his last year of life, when one could say that he was sundowning, but he always had very strange ideas like this. And it's influenced by the work of a Russian mystical midwife named Igor Charkovsky, who I think Posadas believed was a Soviet scientist, but in fact he was, I think, kicked out of the USSR for his experiments. And these were experiments in water birthing. He was a pioneer of the water birthing method, which is still popular today. And in some Black Sea experiments, he believed that dolphins were natural midwives who had come to a woman when she was giving birth and assist in the birthing process psychically. And he believed, of course, that these water births would give the newborn babies the special abilities, like the ability to, for example, swim at an earlier age, to walk at an earlier age, to talk at an earlier age. And this was made all the more potent through the communication with dolphins, because he thought that humans and dolphins had this kind of psychic link. So Posadas really loved this idea because he believed in this very cosmic and mystical unity between humanity, the cosmos, nature, and animals. And he thought that under communism, we would have fraternal relations, not just with all humans, but also with animals, both terrestrial and extraterrestrial. He really believed in the probably too much to talk about right now, but the collapse of subject and object as we know it into this very radical, almost indescribable unity. And I think the dolphin became a symbol of that extreme unity. And he even talked about it quite a bit on his deathbed.
Pretty incredible. I think I'm going to verbalize this quite poorly, but what you were just saying about the kind of ridicule coming from the failure of the, or his belief that there was going to be this big socialist revolution at that time. And then there was also all of his kind of apocalyptic beliefs as well. There was this quote in your book about when Trotsky was making the early predictions about the growth of the Fourth International. You wrote, "As was often the case throughout Trotsky's life, many mistook this optimism for prophecy." And it made me think about whether there's a kind of a danger in blurring prediction and prophecy. Like, I think it's fine to be optimistic and have plans for something to happen, but it's about doing the work to make that happen rather than prophesizing that that's what's going to happen either way, I suppose. I don't know. It's not a very well formulated thought, but that's what it had me thinking about.
Well, but yeah, that's a big part of the book is that, basically Lenin came to power sort of because he had all this legitimacy because he saw that World War One would be this immense catastrophe. He told socialists, don't support it. Turn it into a civil war, basically turn it into a revolution. And then as the war turned out to be like a senseless disaster, there was a revolution in Russia. He shows back up and, you know, understands the situation well enough to take power. But he also expected there to be like that revolution would spread around the world, and it didn't. And the USSR kind of had to defend itself as the one socialist country and wait for capitalism to collapse because it could no longer, the revolution was no longer expanding. And Trotsky, who was a critic of this idea of socialism in one country, is exiled by Stalin from the Soviet Union. He in the 30s really sees World War II coming. He's one of the clearest thinkers of what this war is going to look like, even predicting, you know, elements of the Holocaust in really remarkable ways, predicting that Stalin and Hitler would align and divide up Europe before going to war with one another. But he also thought that it would lead to since the war would be exponentially worse than World War One, the revolution would be exponentially better, and that there would be this massive communist revolution at the end of World War II. And that the Trotskyists, because they had the right idea and the right leadership, would be in a position to lead that revolution. And there is some indications that that could have happened, you know, like a lot of Trotskyists were killed by the Stalinists. That didn't have to be the case. Stalin, the USSR and the other allies kind of worked to disarm communist revolutionaries in places like Italy. That didn't have to happen. You know, certain things happened that didn't have to happen. There could have been something like a revolution. But regardless, it didn't happen. So after the war, some Trotskyists said, well, I guess this wasn't quite right. Let's reformulate, including Trotsky's wife, Natalia Sadova, said, look, some of these things Trotsky wrote in 38 weren't correct or didn't come to pass. But a lot of Trotskyists would not hear that. And they pressed on, believing that essentially World War II hadn't ended, that either it was just on pause or would resume at any moment, because they believed that capitalism was going to collapse at any moment, and that they would go to war with the USSR and then China and North Korea before they let that happen. And then that would be a nuclear third world war. So Posadas didn't invent this idea of this nuclear apocalypse leading to communism. He just held on to that idea longer than anybody else. And, you know, there was some reason to have, there was very intellectual people with this theory of like a communist World War III in the 40s and even the early 50s. But in 55, the economic situation had changed. Capitalism had really recovered in Europe. The USSR was no longer on a war footing. They were looking for peaceful coexistence for the most part. And so a lot of Trotskyists changed their analysis, including Posadas' mentor, Michel Pablo. And Posadas kept it. And he kept it into the 60s. And he continued to be this kind of, the Trotskyists would call him an extreme Pabloist figure into the 60s and 70s, still holding on to this idea that capitalism was going to collapse and nuclear war was coming. And it's really because he treated that stuff like a prophecy and could only really change his analysis if it suited him, like the organization personally in some way, in some small way.
Mm. I think that kind of does lead into the next question I had, which is, you referenced the young Homer Cristalli, which I should say is Posadas's birth name, being forever changed by his childhood experience of the Semana Tragica. I might be pronouncing that poorly. Tragic week. Quote, when patriotic hooligans inflamed by conspiracy theories raided Russian, Jewish and Catalan neighborhoods to drag innocent immigrants from their homes and slaughter them in the street. So I think we're all kind of aware of a lot of conspiracy theory thinking that's going on at the moment that seems fairly ripe for dangerous situations to come of it. It's not going anywhere in over time. And I just wondered, in researching and writing the book, whether there were other things you came across that seem especially relevant in the current climate.
Well, certainly on this topic of conspiracy theories, I tried to pull a lot of that out in the narrative. Posadas was quite the conspiracy theorist himself, in a way that I would describe as vulgar anti-imperialist. So, of course, and I think any socialist should be anti-imperialist, should have a critique of imperialism. But really, socialism at its heart is about class struggle, about the contradiction between the working class and the ownership class. But in the post-war period especially, this becomes sort of changed into a struggle between capitalist states, imperialist states, and worker states, non-imperialist states. So a lot of socialists are really dedicating a lot of their thought and practice to the struggle between the United States and Cuba, for example. And not that they shouldn't, but this becomes more what they're focused on than actual working class struggle, and tends to lead to some very conspiratorial thinking. Like, for example, I was in Cuba a year ago, and if you turn on the Cuban state TV, they'll be talking about how hurricanes are, you know, invented by the United States and things like that. Conspiracy theories are incredibly rampant in Latin American anti-imperialist discourse. Of course, like Russia Today sometimes traffics in these kind of conspiracy theories. And, you know, the United States political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, also use certain kinds of conspiracy theories against Cuba and Russia as well, when they're unable to make their case any other way. So this kind of conspiracy thinking is very vulgar, is what I'm trying to say. It shows a real weakness of deep thinking in your political cause. And Posadas also found himself on the other side of this kind of conspiracism. A lot of his membership, including his own son-in-law, were arrested, tortured, and killed under the anti-communist regimes that culminated in these condor dictatorships in Latin America, primarily in Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil. And especially in Argentina, Juan Perón became very convinced of this so-called syncretic worldview, which was a conspiracy theory that all of the Marxists, all of the Zionists, certain industrialists had this, this secret cabal that were pulling the strings. And this justified this organization, the AAA, the Anti-Communist Alliance, targeting and killing trade union leaders and communists and socialists, burning Marxist literature, that kind of thing. Posadas was on their hit list, but he was in Europe at the time, so they targeted his family and members of his organization. And then another thing that I think is very relevant is something that I just discussed is catastrophism. This idea that we need a disaster to move toward, to change anything. Like, things need to break down before anything can change. Mm. And it's not only saying that that's necessary, but that it's also desirable. That we really want to, like, push things in that direction. You could call that accelerationist or something like that. But that's also a kind of rhetoric that became very pervasive in the left in those decades. I think I see it less now because I think leftists are very keen about the gravity of what collapse would look like. Although there are still some who are accelerationist or against civilization and believe in industrial collapse or something like that. But really the right, the extreme right today, the far right, are very accelerationist and really desire this kind of collapse and civil war. And in the United States, for example, what was the alt-right or the militia movement just a couple of years ago, now many of them identify with this Boogaloo movement, which wants there to be a new second civil war. Mm-hmm. And many of them, not all of them, are very far-right thinking people, neo-Confederates or fascists or something like that.
Yep. There's a lot more I want to talk about that, but I think I'm going to move on to the next question, which is, it's a kind of a broad question, so I'm not sure, but hopefully it'll lead you somewhere. There's so much in your book that's fascinating. I guess it went a lot of places I wasn't expecting it to based on my preconceived notions of Posadism. And I wondered in writing it, which aspects you found most interesting about Posadas and his movement.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I entered the project a lot like you. Like, I wanted to know about the weird stuff. And actually, I first started researching it for a sci-fi story or something like that. What I found was that Posadas was not only a cult leader with weird ideas, he was also kind of an important historical figure in a way. His workers' movement in Argentina was very influential in a way that influenced the uprisings in 68 and 69 in the interior of the country against the dictatorship. His movement was the ideological leaders of the MR-13, which was the first guerrilla organization in Guatemala fighting against the dictatorship in the 60s. And he was the ideological leader of that organization for a short period of time. But there were, you know, guerrillas in the jungle reading Posadas and living revolutionary morality for a short period of time. That and also the wide influence of the Posadists in Cuba, where they are the only Trotskyist party, led Castro to denounce him publicly at a major international congress in 1965, the Tricontinental Congress. He devoted part of his speech to Posadas and all the mistakes he was making. And Che Guevara also, was not a fan of Posadas or Posadism, but did personally intervene to save some of the Trotskyists from prison. And then, like I mentioned, in 1973, he was denounced personally by Juan Perón in a very strange incident that, you know, I describe in the book. But it was kind of a mystery of why Perón talked about Posadas publicly like that, at kind of a turning point in his own politics, because he was this, you know, idiosyncratic third positionist figure. And really, around that time he denounces Posadas, he moves from the left to the right. So I was interested in seeing Posadas as this kind of hinge, this like key figure at certain points in history, as this sort of scapegoat, as someone who was denounced and mocked, and what it meant in those situations. But of course, I was also interested in that sex scandal that I mentioned, where that came from, and the aftermath of it, in which he had a daughter with a young member of the movement who he'd basically dedicated the entire movement to raising this girl as his messianic heir. Like, he was really this pedagogical experiment in creating, like, the next socialist leader. And I was very curious to see what happened with that experiment, and I talk about it a little bit in the book, although I couldn't go into too much detail to respect her privacy. But really, I was interested in, I think the overall thing I was interested in by the end of it was understanding Posadas as a metaphor for what happened to revolutionary socialism in the 20th century. How it went from this moment where millions of workers all around the world were mobilizing with basically a common vision of stateless communism in like the end of the 1910s. To being this strange sectarian cult-like thing that most people mock when they try to hand you a newspaper. What was that transition? This was the transition of Posadas' entire life. This was the narrative arc of Posadas' life. And, you know, he was mocked for that. He was like a particularly comical figure, but it was also the movement of revolutionary socialism in general. And I wanted to use that metaphor of Posadism to kind of understand what those failures were, what those successes were, why people, you know, fought and died and like submitted themselves to that kind of, abuse and torture and assassination. Was it simply that they had been duped by a charismatic leader, or, was there really a possibility of preventing the kind of horrific situation we're in today as we just spiral into dystopia? I wanted to investigate that too with an interest towards trying to figure out what to do next.
Mm. I think that's often what I feel is the tragedy of many of these cultic groups, is that most people who join them are joining them with a real sense of wanting to do something significant and change the world. Like, they're driven by a core motivation that's, you know, I mean, often it's about changing themselves, it's about improving themselves if it's a more self-help type group. But with any of the political or even the religious groups, it's often really about trying to do something meaningful to change the world and to make it a better place. And it's such a shame that so much energy ends up being put behind these controlling charismatic leaders who lead it all astray, I suppose. So after Posadas's death, many expected his following to kind of disappear entirely, but that's not quite what happened. And I wondered if you could give me your impression of where his following is at today.
Yeah, sure. So the small group of people that were around him when he died continued on the tasks of the International. They were as marginal as ever, although they did have some influence in Argentina and Uruguay and Brazil as they moved out from dictatorship to democracy. But as far as I can tell, they never really recruited any new people or very few new people. They certainly never started building cadres again like they had in the 40s and 50s. And so Posadism today is led, I think it's split between the European Posadists and the Latin American Posadists. But the official leader, as far as I can tell, is Leon Cristalli, Posadas's son, who did not talk to me for the book, but I was able to talk to the Uruguayan leader of his International. And they are all very old men. I think maybe there's one of them who's under 50, but most of them are in their 70s. And I got this impression from watching their activity and trying to interact with them that although they are very proud and sure of what they do, continuing to be a part of, for example, the Kirchnerismo coalition in Argentina, the Frente Amplio, this leftist coalition that was in power until recently in Uruguay, and the Workers' Party in Brazil, as well as supporting Chavismo and the Bolivarian regime in Venezuela. Although they're very proud of this work, they seemed content to just let the Posadas movement die with them. And I believe that it will be, but already it's somewhat has been, surpassed by this thing that I call neo-Posadism, which is the Posadism that was reinvented in memes. And people who are interested in like these extreme, strange things about Posadas, and have some of them have satirically identified as Posadists. there's this meme page called the Intergalactic Workers League Posadists, which has tens of thousands of members. A lot of people on Twitter call themselves Posadists. Ironically, people actually go out to like May Day demonstrations, like claiming that they're Posadists and stuff. Not a lot, but. If you look at, I looked at Google searches for Posadas versus the other Trotskyist figures that he was rivals with in his time, and he's a more popular or a more searched for figure than them, almost to a man, at least in the United States and England. And at times, he was more searched for than Trotsky himself. So in the last chapter, I talk about the political relevance of these memes and this meme culture, where people who are, know that the world is really messed up and want to try to figure out how people have fought it before and try to educate themselves about socialism are encountering a lot of these ideas and figures for the first time through memes. They're certainly not going to learn about it in school. There's not these like socialist organizations everywhere like there were 100 years ago that you could just go and join. So they're looking at Facebook groups and they're seeing these memes of people like Posadas. And so that's one of the first faces you see when you're a young person learning about socialism. And I try to theorize that although this is a very ironic way to represent Posadas, it's not wholly in mocking him. It's not purely negative. And to the extent that it is ironic, we're in a very ironic situation where we have all the technology and all the resources to not destroy the world, to not, keep moving towards climate Armageddon and world war and, all these various catastrophes, but we don't know how to not do that. It's a very ironic situation that nobody seems to seriously want to change. And socialism has always said, this is the choice humanity has, socialism or barbarism. And now barbarism seems like the only possibility. And I think young people, even younger than you or I, more like teens and early 20s, are attracted to Posadas. Because he understood that this catastrophist impulse, and he did it with this kind of manic optimism that was very attractive to them. So I think that's what Posadism is today. He's this avatar for cosmic thinking, for this xenophilia, this love of the other, of the extraterrestrial, of the animal, the immigrant and the refugee or what have you. But also he's this figure of extreme political thought, of like extreme violence to get us to the next stage that I think people are kind of bracing themselves for?
I think that's the end of my question. So is there anything that you'd like to mention that we haven't covered already?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would love for your listeners to check out the book. I mean, I listen to your show. I listen to every episode. I really like it. And the only thing I worry about, and I try to walk this line in the book, is that when we look at cults, especially in this case, political cults, there's like this temptation to say, well, these people joined because they needed some structure in their life. They were lacking a father figure. They needed a community. And it was this kind of individual insufficiency that brought them into these situations. And it's important that we avoid doing that ourselves. And of course it is. I would not recommend anyone join a cult even as an experiment or something. However, I wonder if some of those things that people get when they join a cult, they might avoid worrying that they would join a cult. Like, for example, I do think we really need community and some structure in our lives. And if we do want to fight capitalism, we do need to have some discipline in doing so. So we need some of that stuff. We just need it without that abuse and without falling, under the spell of a charismatic leader and being brainwashed. We need to think for ourselves. And I think even if we do think for ourselves, we could come to the conclusion that fighting for communism or living communism is a worthy goal. But this is kind of an open question of the book. So I encourage listeners to pick it up.
Can you just repeat the title of the book for us and the best place that people can find it?
Sure. It's I Want to Believe, Pessimism, UFOs, and Apocalypse Communism. It's from Pluto Press, so you can get it from their website. You can also get it from Topos Books in the United States if you want to support an independent bookshop. I'm at SpacePearl on Twitter, and I've got a link to all the places you can order it. And you can get it from the normal websites as well.
I would, really recommend giving it a read to all listeners. It's a very interesting journey. And you also have a podcast?
Yep, I'm the co-host of the Antifada podcast, where we talk about, mostly revolutionary left politics in the United States.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me about your really interesting book. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening, and go out and read the book to find out even more about the Posadists. You'll find a link with a 20% discount code in the show notes. If you've been personally affected by involvement in a cult, or would like to support those who have been, you can find support or donate to Cult Information and Family Support if you're in Australia via www.cifs.org.au. And you can find resources outside of Australia with the International Cultic Studies Association via www.icsahome.com. Let's Talk About Sects is produced and presented by me, Sarah Steele. Sound design and music is by Joe Gould. A big thanks to A.M. Gitlitz for sharing his time and knowledge with me for this bonus episode. I hope you can join me again next episode.
The Troubles in Northern Ireland was an extremely volatile 30-year period in which thousands of people were killed on both sides of the conflict. Most people know very little about this period, and a lot of the material can be incredibly complex and hard to separate fact from opinion. The Troubles podcast is an introduction to the major events that occurred during the Troubles, devoting an episode to each incident. It's a non-partisan, true crime-style podcast that explains the motivations and planning behind the attacks, as well as the consequences, both short-term and long. The first 10 episodes have covered many different events, including when Lord Louis Mountbatten was blown up at sea by the IRA, or when Ireland's favourite show band, the Miami, were ambushed and killed on their way home from a concert by loyalist paramilitaries, as well as the Shankill Butchers, who are the most prolific group of serial killers in the United Kingdom. The podcast is perfect for those who want to learn more about such a volatile period in Northern Irish history. It's also a great companion for fans of historical true crime. You can find the podcast at shows.acast.com/the-troubles-podcast or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thanks.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.